It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Today, I wanted to share, I'm afraid, you know, is that the word? Afraid? I am concerned of what's coming. And we're going to be attacked emotionally. We always have been. This has been steady since forever, but, you know, it's become a science. It's gotten to the point that they would do subliminal go-buy-cokes, little quarter-second ads in the film preview, kind of, man, everybody crowding around the soda stand in the movie theater. If they can do it and get away with it, they will. People go to me all the time and they'll say, do you think this and you believe in this conspiracy? And I go, before I even look into the facts, all I need to know is, will it expand the scope, power, reach, influence of the government into your life to benefit them? Well, if they can, they will. Now, is there some moral hurdle they got to overcome? Oh, we wouldn't do that. You know, that would be bad, right? they'll lie you in the war. They'll steal your pension. They'll deflate your money. They'll, rob you, murder you, do all kinds of stuff. But they wouldn't do, we wouldn't do election fraud. That'd be wrong, you know. So this is seriously. And I had a gentleman, one of the activists, was here this morning. We're working on some projects. And he said, hey, I started reading Garrison's book. And it was the lawyer in JFK. Oliver Stone did the movie JFK, and it was about the attorney in New Orleans that was, prosecuting, the only prosecution that went on this thing, and got a lot of facts out. And it was an interesting movie. I mean, I should watch it again. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen that, but it was, he's going, wow, I've been reading the book. Oh my goodness, the book is so much better. Did you know? And this one little thing here, I bet you didn't know. Did you know? And I go, what are you trying to do? Tell me that the government's really, 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 really bad? You want me to add on another really? I mean, at what point do I go, okay, I get it, So I don't care about them. And a lot of talk show hosts, I know they do. They give you the names. They tell you who did what today. They go on. I mean, in the first hour, we talked a little bit about Bernanke. I mean, just a lineage as it goes back, from Bernanke to Greenspan and Greenspan, even back to Ayn Rand, the objectivist, this libertarian philosophy thing. He knows better. He wrote papers on the gold standard and all this kind of stuff. That's why when he sold out and he gets up before Congress, Ron Paul just slaps Greenspan around every chance he got. And here comes Bernanke, just same thing, So this has been going on for a long time. And even at a young age in my 20s and so on, it was being explained to me, and I want to share it with you and some of the other things that I found. Well, what we're talking about now, and I mentioned it yesterday, is the movie The Century of the Self. And we played a little bit in the first hour, five, six, 7 minutes of how Sigmund Freud's concept of emotion running our lives more than we would like to think. You try and do this Victorian, prim and proper kind of keep your feelings to yourself and just go die for empire, or at least come back with an arm missing or something, and you did your bit, and stiff upper lip and all that, cheerio. And this is the revelation that he had, that people are much more driven and moved, and certainly as the masses are moved by emotion. The one that's most taken advantage of is fear. It's an external or internal threat. I mean, you know, there's always a threat. And to the point that it used to be it was a threat to our freedom. And then it got to be is that freedom was the threat. We need to give up more of our freedom to be more secure. I mean, I seen the shift. I mean, I'm sure you have too. Did you even recognize it? It used to be they're threatening our freedom. Fascism's threatening our freedom. Communism's threatening our freedom. We got to be a bigger, badder collective to beat up that collective. You know, give us the power, we'll take care of it for you. You know, give me the Tonkin Resolution. I mean, give me the ability to go to war, you know, without the Congress Declaration kind of thing, Presidential War Powers Act, that kind of thing. You give that to me, I'll take care of it for you. Don't worry about it. So I've seen this happen. And it's got to the point now to where they don't even say that it's a threat to our freedom. Freedom is the threat. They hate us for our freedom. We're too free. So what was the cure? Take away our freedom? Then they won't hate us anymore? You know, papers, please? This is, and you'll beg for it. You'll beg for it. Because they know how to get the masses. They get you afraid. Immigration. Damn Mexicans. Foreigners. Is that really the threat? Do you even know what to look for? Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, he was a press agent at the time for Caruso, which was a big opera singer and so on back in the day. And so he knew how to deal with the press. He knew how to get him to whatever. And he read his uncle Sigmund Freud's book on psychoanalysis and how it portrayed to influencing people with their base emotions and this kind of thing. And then he goes, oh, I can do this. This is good. So he came back. You know, Woodrow Wilson is going after World War II or World War I. He goes out, and they're making him a big hero in France. He's here to save the planet. We're going to make the planet safe for democracy. They wouldn't even make it safe. It was just safe for democracy. And the only thing I can think of, I'm going, wow, man, you had all these monarchies before, you know, the Huns, what do they call them, the Tsar of this and the Kaiser of that and the King and Queen of what you call it and the Prince and Duke of such and such. And you go, no, we're not here to restore the old order. We want a new order of democracy. Well, when you have these royal families, it's much more difficult to take them over. I mean, how do you vote them out or something? I mean, you got to kill them, and then all the relatives and all the, you know, that's exactly what they did in Russia. You know, the Tsar and his family and everything. That's where the big legend is about the one daughter that lived and all that kind of stuff. Well, they, you know, man, we're gonna take care of this. You know, bloodline, it'd be running in the streets. That's it. You know, it's in the gutter now. That's where the bloodline is. See that line go down the gutter? That's your bloodline. Done. Wilson kind of offered the same solution. And he's like, we're going to make the world safe for democracy. Well, then you think and you go, you know, it's a lot easier, a lot less bloodshed, you know, to have an entire change of government with every election. Now, if you can control the election, then you're all set. That's when they call it the Australian ballot. And the reason was because that's how Australia was the first to really start doing this at the direction of the Queen in England. Because, you know, the Queen, you know, a lot of people don't know. We were looking to move to New Zealand. And we were just looking for a lot of places. You know, we knew that it was going to get, bad here. And at our Freedom Summit, we had a gentleman that's what he did. He helped people get their papers, please, and order and whatever to be resident or even citizens in New Zealand. In fact, a good friend, Jason Ovenshine, was the state chair of the Libertarian Party here in Arizona, lived in Tucson. He and his family, they went down to New Zealand, and they shared a home here and there, and went back, and they did everything they could to qualify to get citizenship in New Zealand because they were so afraid. They're raising a young family. Now, his kids are probably in I don't know, first, second grade now. And he goes, no, I know what's coming. You know, so we're, and he had the wherewithal. He's a big IBM computer geek guy, so he could do his work from anywhere around the planet. Went to New Zealand, got citizenship. So I'm going, okay. So this, you know, this is, hits close to home to us. A lot of, you know, my partner on the Freedom Summit, he and his wife and some other friends of mine, I didn't go with them, but, cause I couldn't afford it at the time. They went to New Zealand for at least a couple of weeks, met with a lot of different people, talked to them. That's how I hooked up for a Freedom Summit, had this guy come and talk. So the one thing that we found out was that they have a thing called the Queen's Privy Council. And that if we go there and we're effective political activists and we get things changed, we start changing the culture, it makes it all the way to the Supreme Court and we're, yay, we changed it. The Queen of England gets to go, nah, I veto. Parts of Canada, you know, in Canada, Australia, New Zealand. She still rules now. Heck, they even got her on the money. Did you know it?
There are those that just want to be left alone. And those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Hancock, and I wanted to make sure that I'm busy typing stuff. You know, God, there's so much stuff we're going on. I'll tell you all about another day. But let me tell you what I wanted to make sure that I got out before we went back to Edward Bernays. What we had was an idea that can we go be free somewhere? I mean, we just want to be free. We just want to be left alone. You know, I don't have an allegiance to a government that's beating me over the head all the time. That's, I mean, at what point did the German people go, you know what? I'm not pledging allegiance to the flag anymore. I mean, when did that happen? I mean, was there ever a time? No, you must support it no matter what. You know, as they're rolling the Allied tanks down the street. I mean, there's got to be a point. So we're looking. You know, my allegiance is to my family. I remember getting a questionnaire from the newspaper here, the Arizona Republic, one of the major newspapers when I was running for Congress one time. And they said, where do you call home? And what they wanted, the issue was a lot of people, certainly right after they gerrymandered districts after a census and so on, they are always, and they'll do it probably by the next election cycle, that you'll have all kinds of people coming from all over the place running in a new congressional district that they just moved in from Virginia kind of thing. You know, yeah, I used to be with the CIA, but, you know, I want to be a congressman now. So that's happened before. So what they did is they sent out a questionnaire going, okay, where do you call home? Well, to me, I mean, it wasn't a big, giant deal, and it made cause such an up. Well, it wasn't really an uproar. I got a lot of letters of support and so on and such from it. It just didn't even occur to me because when they asked me, I go, wherever my family is. Where's home? I don't know, wherever my family is, done. Didn't even occur to me to think of, you know, I'm going to give some government geographical jurisdictional listing of what they say allow. You know, I was born in Florida. I lived in Arizona. I, you know, thinking of going somewhere. I mean, you know, where's home? You know, I don't think in terms of cities or states or I'm wherever my family is. You know, next question. And it made such a big deal. And I'm going, wow, these people are so messed up in the head. What? You don't wear the jersey? And I'm like, wow. I mean, I have a little Arizona flag on the front of my my wife's car. Had it. It came when we got it. I kind of like it. It's cool. It's pretty. You know, we don't have to have license plates on the front of the cars here in Arizona, just on the back. So, you know, we have a nice Arizona, you know, flag. You know, that, you know, it's cool. I think it looks cool. Everybody knows, yeah, from Arizona. Yeah, whatever. You know, but it's because of the people here, not because the government. Heck, we're worse off, you know, per capita here in Arizona than California. We're the worst in the nation, number 50, and how much in debt we are. You don't hear a lot about, do you? Well, the reason is because we're a smaller state. You know, California is like the sixth largest economy or something. You know, Arizona is just, you know, way down on the list. But gosh darn it, you know what? My granddaughter still owes more than granddaughters of people in California, they say. You know, so I'm, you know, I see where the mentality is coming from. Well, as we're going around the world, we're looking for, you know, is there a place to go? Well, you know, there's a lot of places people, you know, kind of will hide here for a year or two before it gets too bad. Okay, then we'll go over here. And those that have resources can do that, or those that have nothing to lose and they live by hitchhiking, I mean, they can do it too. Heck, they do it here in the country. Nobody knows they're there. And we're going to see a whole bunch of them in Porkfest up in New Hampshire at the end of this month in New Hampshire up on the Canadian border. The Free State Project puts up every year this thing called Porkfest, and it's just a big camping thing. There'll be 1,000 people there. It's like Burning Man for people that like freedom. You'll see some of the ads on freedomsphoenix.com. You click on it, go to it, you go, wow, man, that's a party. And there's just a bunch of, oh, and there's reindeer shooting games. No, they're going to have shooting. You know, you go there and they have a lot of opportunities to just go and target shoot, you know, talk. It's just going to be fun. So we're going. We're going to be doing the radio show from there. I'm taking all my remote equipment and we're going to go and we'll do it up. You know, we'll be there interviewing a lot of the guys there, why they're there and stuff. We'll make you guys an intimate part of that. Because usually I, you know, we're going to do our best to go ahead and do, even though it's camping and they got enough facilities, we check. Because I've been doing traveling and doing a lot of stuff. So I'm like, I didn't feel comfortable with doing guest host too much if I can get away with it. And we're going to go ahead and take the remote equipment up there and do it from the Pork Fest. Well, one thing that we found out while we're going around, a lot of the English speaking countries, because, you know, English would have been better than not. We found out is if you go high up on the pyramid in the government, okay, so let's say we get active. Let's say we advocate for freedom. Let's say we're doing, let's say we get something to the Supreme Court. Let's say we, you know, have a change in government. Let's say that we're getting, you know, freedom. Heck no. There's a thing called the Queen's Privy Council. Her Majesty's Most Honorable Privy Council is a body of advisors to the British sovereign. Its members are largely senior politicians who were or are members of either the House of Commons or the House of Lords of the United Kingdom, Great Britain, Northern Ireland. The Privy Council, the successor of the Privy Council of England, was formerly a powerful institution, but its policy decisions are now controlled by one of its committees, the Cabinet of the United Kingdom. It advises the sovereign on the exercise of the royal prerogative. Okay, so this Privy Council is just a council, blah, 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 this guy, that guy, whatever. It's to advise the sovereign, the queen, on the exercise of the royal prerogative. Well, we might want to know what that royal prerogative thing is, don't we? And issues executive orders known as orders in council and orders of council. Orders in council make government regulation and appointments. Orders of council are issued under specific authority acts of parliament, which delegate such matters to the council, yada, 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 yada. The council also performs judicial functions, which are for the most part delegated to the judicial committee, and it goes on and on and on. And it gets down to the bottom line is that they have veto power of the supreme highest courts of these other countries, because they are still the ultimate person in charge. Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Didn't know that, did you? Although the Privy Council is primarily a British institution, officials from some other Commonwealth realms are also appointed to the body. By 2000, the most notable instances was New Zealand, whose prime minister, senior politicians, chief justice of the Court of Appeal judges were conventionally made privy councillors. However, appointments of New Zealand members have since been discontinued. I think one of the big reasons, we looked into that before, it was because of their no nukes in their harbors thing. You know, that was what the big deal was. They weren't going to play, and they, you know, the people say, all right, fine, you don't get to be on the Privy Council. But these meetings are done in order that they have the ability to veto whatever the country going through its highest things, and they go, nah, we say, nope, can't change it, or it's got to be this way. But they don't tell people that. And when we started studying this, okay, well, what's the, you know, we want to know the, if we're going to go there, I just want to understand the politics. We're trying to go find a free place. You're not. So you have the Queen's Privy Council, and it's got veto power. on these countries. And you don't think so? She's printed on the money. I mean, you know, come on, you know. So and when we come back after the bottom of the hour break, we'll go ahead and go into the rest of how, and because this all ties into this public relations thing of Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Because what he was able to do with that information and unlimited resources of government and corporations and so on, he's like, okay, I get it. So there's a collective mind out there. How do we control it? How do we direct it? Well, of course, you can use fear and all this other kind of stuff and other emotions. But there's certain, and the example we're going to get is how do you get to make it cool for women to smoke? It's just a test. They just to see if they could. You know, it's just, and then they, oh, this is working out. But they always got to appeal to a better part of your nature. They twist it. We'll talk about it when we come back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Turn on the tube.
Ernest Hancock here from Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, you know where it's lovely, 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 even when it's hot, and it's getting hot. You know the Queen's Privy Council. You know, here's the sense I was looking for. It was formerly a Supreme Court of Appeal for the entire British Empire, and continues to hear appeals from British overseas territories, sovereign base areas, crown dependencies, and some Commonwealth countries. Which ones are those? Yeah, some of the big ones. So this is, they never tell you this stuff at junior high. you just don't know. And how are they able to get away with this? They're going to make the world safe for democracy. What did that mean? You know, so you have democracy. Well, it's a lot easier, especially now that you don't need a tank. You just need a floppy disk. It's not safe from the floppy disk, for democracy, computer election fraud. I mean, it's because they can. You think, are they? Do they do that? Yeah. Can they? They are. Okay. So that's my opinion on that. Well, you need to get the populace involved in this. And I've started to find that, the more information that people have, the more access to the internet, the more access to just raw data, they're not falling for it as much as they used to. So they kind of changed tactics. We'll get into this a little bit with Edward Bernays, but, I think they've changed tactics. They've gone to, you don't have to convince you. They just have to convince you that they convinced all your neighbors. Yeah, you know what's going on, but your neighbors are stupider than heck. They're dumb morons. Yeah, maroon. Yeah, because I know what's going on, but they don't. It was a couple weeks ago, they had a local city election here for raising some city tax on something. Whatever. And they had this go, and everybody against it, in line, everybody was against, gets it past the 65%. They're going, what the heck? They want to do signs and billboards and whatever, election fraud. This is all, I'm going, yeah, power to you, go. I mean, were you going to convince me that, it's rigged? It's a cultural thing. We got to change us. Well, they know that too. Big, bad, bad guys. They, them, those. Not us. Those that won't leave us alone. Those guys. Okay. Well, Edward Bernays was charged. This was back in probably the 20s, 30s, saying, we're trying to get to break this tab. Just see if we can. We'll pay you a bunch of money if you'll go ahead and find out what we can do. And he got, a psychotherapist or something to kind of analyze this and why the women, what do they see cigarettes as and how can we use it to change and get. And it's all this kind of propaganda, PR, brainwashing thing. Well, let's go ahead and get back to it and we'll learn something.
He said, "What'll it cost?" So I called up Dr. Brill, A.A. Brill, who was a leading psychoanalyst in New York at that time.
How come you didn't call your uncle? Why didn't you call your uncle?
Because he was in Vienna.
A.A. Brill was one of the first psychoanalysts in America. And for a large fee, he told Bernays that cigarettes were a symbol of the penis and of male sexual power. He told Bernays that if he could find a way to connect cigarettes with the idea of challenging male power, then women would smoke, because then they would have their own penises. Every year, New York held an Easter Day parade to which thousands came, and Bernays decided to stage an event there. He persuaded a group of rich debutantes to hide cigarettes under their clothes. Then they should join the parade, and at a given signal from him, they were to light up the cigarettes dramatically. Bernays then informed the press that he had heard that a group of suffragettes were preparing to protest by lighting up what they called torches of freedom.
He knew this would be an outcry, and he knew that all of the photographers would be there to capture this moment, and so he was ready with a phrase, which was torches of freedom. And so here you have a symbol, women, young women, debutantes, smoking a cigarette in public with a phrase that means anybody who believes in this kind of equality pretty much has to support them in the ensuing debate about this, because torches of freedom. I mean, that's on all American coins. It's liberty. She's holding up the torch, you see? And so all of this is there together. There's emotion, there's memory, there's a rational phrase, even though it's using a lot of emotional elements. It's a phrase that works in a rational sense. All of this is together. And so the next day, this was not just in all of the New York papers, it was across the United States and around the world. And from that point forward, the sale of cigarettes to women began to rise. He had made them socially acceptable with a single symbolic act.
What Bernays had created was the idea that if a woman smoked, it made her more powerful and independent. An idea that still persists today.
Embrace me.
You start to see how simple it, I mean, you would think it's simple. You're going, wow, well, of course. I mean, you know, it seems logical. I mean, you know, that you would be able to have that kind of influence on people by associating certain acts or things with positive things. It's symbolic. It's symbology. Well, what do you think the Lovolution logo was all about? Revolution with love. It was already test marketed. In 2006, we had it and used as stickers for my room for Secretary of State here in 2006 in Arizona. And it was just so popular, and I knew why. You know, I mean, it's, you know, people wanted revolutionary change, but they didn't want to advocate violence. And this was a really good way for them to express themselves. So when Dr. Paul made the announcement he was going to run, we already knew what we were going to do. I already knew what was going to happen, too. It was going to get stupid. It was going to explode everywhere. And it was about what I expected. I mean, you know, a lot of times you expect, you know, more than you get, but it didn't surprise me what happened. Because I had been active for so long, I knew that there was this pent up, and from what happened in 06 with that logo, heck, they didn't know who was on, you know, who was running. You know, we had in small print. I was more interested with the logo and getting that concept out than I was. I just put my name, you know, candidate for Secretary of State just as an excuse to be able to do the sticker. You know, I didn't care about that. It's always a cultural war with me. So I'm going, okay. You know, so this stuff, later I would watch this Century of the Self series, and this is just part of an hour program that's just part of a four-hour program. So you go, it's called the Century of the Self, and I put it up on the front page of Freedom's Phoenix. You watch this thing, and you will go, ooh, man, what the heck? This is common knowledge to people that are brainwashing you. There was another one that they did. It's called The Power of Nightmares. And I want to share that with you. I haven't seen that in a while, too. But I remember the intro being kind of, you know, dramatic. Excuse me. What they did is they're going, there's a history of how they used fear, and certainly even the Muslim fear kind of thing. That and then you hear about how the CIA is working with bin Laden during the Afghanistan resistance to Soviet Union, and all the contacts that we made with them, and how we got integrated into Pakistan, and Saddam was our boy in Iraq, and then in Iran we had our guy the Shah, and then we don't, and now you have all of these things, and a lot of times they'll use the fear of them. And even over there, they're using the fear of us in order to manipulate people, using what Bernays was talking about, you know, this emotional response to get whatever they wanted. I'll tell you what's changing, though. It is the direct peer-to-peer communication with Google translators or whatever translator they're using in an immediate, instant messaging, Twitter, Facebook, right then I type it, it translates it into whatever, going with my counterpart and peer in Iran. When you have a 17 to 23-year-old person here that some of their best friends are in other countries and speak several different languages, and because technology has taken the barriers away, how do you convince them we're going to go bomb the living crap out of them? We're going to shock and awe them in the Stone Age. How do you rationalize that to a 17, 18-year-old kid? There was one, I think it was called At the River's End. It was a blog. And it was this young woman that was talking about, you know, I think it was a young woman. She never really said, I don't think. And we would follow her blog in Baghdad. As the occupation started, the war started, she just detailed everything. It was fascinating. For years we did that, and how people close to her were dying and so on. That's what's going on all over.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Open up your mind and let me step inside. Rest your weary head and let your heart decide. It's so
I mean, it, all you have to do is just, just let me come inside and mess with your head. You know, that's what I get out of that one song right there. It's just like, it's so easy. Well, there's a method to it. There's a way. You know, it's through your emotions. You know, they advise young women that get married and everything, best way to a man's heart is through his stomach. You know, it's an emotional thing. You know, you want to get to his heart, there's other ways to get there. But I tell you, you know, it's you feed our primal needs, and you're our new best friend. Well, one of those primal effects, you know, that they can tap into, get on, is fear. And there was another series that BBC did years ago called The Power of Nightmares. And it was just as impactful to me. As a matter of fact, I think I saw this one before I did The Century of Self. I don't even know how I came across Century of Self. I just happened to, because it was linked to this one somehow. I just started watching, like, oh, my goodness, I'm going to be watching more of these BBC things. And, well, of course, they get in trouble, too. You know, they're the ones that different channels do different things. And they're still kind of government-controlled thing. And they did this one, the global warming swindle. And boy, did they cause an uproar in that one. They keep taking it down. In fact, they keep doing it on this one, too. Somebody keeps putting them up in various different places. Because what I'll do is I'll link to it, and I'll put it on Ernie's Favorites, which is a special edition on Freedom's Phoenix. You go in the top navigation bar up there, you'll see on the second line it says Special Editions. It'll have a drop down. The fourth one down says Ernie's Favorites. And I always put these there so that people can get access to them because they're cool. I mean, there's good information. I'll refer to them a lot. And even if they break the link, you can copy and paste the title in Google and they'll find it. Well, at least it will now, but, you know, Lord knows what will happen in the future. But I keep having to do this because it keeps severing the link. They keep, you know, deleting it. They take it out. Somebody complains. There's, you know, whatever. So it doesn't always stay up there for a real long period of time until they start putting it in other type of, like this one is Viddler, you know, for videos, I guess. And they have all these different types of services that you can upload video to get access to it. And I want to play the beginning of this. It's just the intro of the series, The Power of Nightmares. Now, keep in mind, this was done, it was after 9/11. I think it was probably only about 4 years ago or something. But you'll get the gist of it. Here we go.
In the past, politicians promised to create a better world. They had different ways of achieving this, but their power and authority came from the optimistic visions they offered their people. Those dreams failed, and today people have lost faith in ideologies. Increasingly, politicians are seen simply as managers of public life. But now, they have discovered a new role that restores their power and authority. Instead of delivering dreams, politicians now promise to protect us from nightmares. They say that they will rescue us from dreadful dangers that we cannot see and do not understand. And the greatest danger of all is international terrorism, a powerful and sinister network with sleeper cells in countries across the world. A threat that needs to be fought by a war on terror. But much of this threat is a fantasy, which has been exaggerated and distorted by politicians. It's a dark illusion that has spread unquestioned through governments around the world, the security services, and the international media. This is a series of films about how and why that fantasy was created, and who it benefits. At the heart of the story are two groups, the American neoconservatives and the radical Islamists. Both were idealists who were born out of the failure of the liberal dream to build a better world. And both had a very similar explanation of what caused that failure. These two groups have changed the world, but not in the way that either intended. Together, they created today's nightmare vision of a secret organized evil that threatens the world. A fantasy that politicians then found restored their power and authority in a disillusioned age. And those with the darkest fears became the most powerful.
The Power of Nightmares. It's so predictable what's coming because it's happened over and over and over in the past. The ones with the biggest dreams used to be the ones that were the supported the most. Kennedy. Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy. You know, the founders of this country, Thomas Jefferson. Christ, Gandhi. You know, I mean, you know, the people with the biggest dreams were the ones that were the most notable, the most sort of supported. And now, even now, are the most long-lasting. But there are those that come to power that usually it's those people that oppose. They come to power based on fear. Are you feared enough yet? Huh? Are you feared? You need to be afeared. Because that's what gives them their power. And that's why I, you know, the opening segment that we have, that's Morpheus from the second Matrix when he's in the cave. You know, hear me. And we are not afraid. And there's a reason, is because if you understand what's really going on, you know, you're just not as afraid. But there's, you know, there's a lot of people that they don't really understand what this is about. And we talked yesterday, we used some movie clips to kind of make the point that there is a reason why you have these enormous blockbuster movies that are so popular. What is the common thread? I'll tell you what it is. It is the individual against the collective. Every one of these movies, Matrix, the individual against the Matrix, the government, You have Braveheart, the individual against the king that's, you know, won't leave him alone. Patriot, same thing. Gladiator, one man, you know, against an emperor, the whole empire. V for Vendetta, V against, you know, totalitarian 1984 Big Brother government. Serenity, you know, we're going to space, you know, burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me. Okay, they go into space and government's not invited, but here they come anyway. You know, they're just trying to be left alone. You know, these popular movies that people wonder, why are they such blockbusters? And it's not whether they're big budget or not. It's that they accurately portray, they tap into the emotion of the people that just want to be left alone. It's the individual against the collective. I mean, think about a lot of your favorite movies. You know, there's some aspect of that. You know, I mean, rarely is it the collective against the individual, and yay! You know, I mean, he has to be a really bad guy, be Dr. Evil or something. And, you know, and there's a lot of phrases. The Matrix was one of the few movies. There's only been three, I guess, that there's been that I've went and saw a second time, like the next day or later that day. Took someone, I go, yeah, you'll like this. We got to go see it. One was the Matrix. And one was Princess Bride. And I saw Avatar like four times in a month, so I guess that one qualifies. Because everybody I knew once, I go, yeah, it's a good movie. Well, I wanted to go see it. I've been seeing it. I go, yeah, I'll go see it again. You know, I enjoyed the 3D. I really enjoyed that movie, so I didn't mind. You know, it's all good. So I give that one, you know, a pass. But the Princess Bride, because I knew my nephews were going to love it. You know, they were like six, seven at the time. I went and saw it with a friend. I go, oh, yeah. And I was going, they're going to be sword fighting, you know, around the house, you know, for the rest of their life. So we went and saw that right away. And then the other one that really had the biggest impact on me was The Matrix. 1995, I think it was, first came out. And I, man, did they do what I think they did? And if you could watch the first Matrix 40 times and still get more and more out of it. And it really came down to, you know, a couple of scenes. And I think this one kind of portrayed it, what this was really all about.
The Matrix is a system, Neo. That system is our enemy. When you're inside, you look around. What do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters, the very minds of the people we are trying to save. But until we do, these people are still a part of that system, and that makes them our enemy. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it. Were you listening to me, Neo? Or were you looking at the woman in the red dress?
I was...
Look again. Who is it?
What are they?
Sentient programs. Anyone we haven't unplugged is potentially an agent. Inside the Matrix, they are everyone, and they are no one. They are guarding all the doors, they are holding all the keys, which means that sooner or later, someone is going to have to fight them.
Someone.
I won't lie to you, Neo. Every single man or woman who has stood their ground, everyone who has fought an agent has died. But where they have failed, you will succeed.
Why?
Their strength and their speed are still based in a world that is built on rules. Because of that, they will never be as strong or as fast as you can be.
What are you trying to tell me? That I can dodge bullets?
No, Neo. Trying to tell you that when you're ready,